Welcome to the Economics Explained podcast. I'm your host, Gene Tunney. Governments around the world are spending billions of dollars to support their economies in this time of the COVID crisis. My guest today has recently written a paper for the Australian Centre for Independent Studies, a leading Australian think tank, on a fiscal vaccine for COVID-19. The author is Professor Tony Makin of Griffith University. Tony, thanks for joining me today.
It's a pleasure, Gene.
Excellent. Tony, I'm looking forward to chatting about your paper. The Centre for Independent Studies is running a program, Pandemic to Prosperity. So there's going to be a series of working papers. It's possible that I'll have one coming out in this series in the next couple of months. Your paper deals with the massive government response we've seen here in Australia. It's a response that you've characterised as crude Keynesianism. So one of the great lines from your paper is, the paper considers the resurgence of crude Keynesianism before highlighting risks of the fiscal legacy. Now, coming out of that great statement there, there are two questions. The first is, what is crude Keynesianism? What do you mean by that? And the second one will be, what is the fiscal legacy and the risks of it? So perhaps if you could start with your definition of crude Keynesianism, please, Tony.
Yeah, sure, Gene. Look, I think of crude Keynesianism as simply the idea that if governments spend, irrespective of what they spend on, they can spend on anything, that that will stimulate, and I use the word advisedly, and I put it in quotes, stimulate the economy. And students learn this even at high school. They learn it in their first year at university, that big G, if you like, is part of the is a key aggregate in the national account, C plus I plus G plus X minus M. If you increase G, you're going to increase big Y, that is national income. And the device that best captures the theory of crude Keynesianism is the so-called Keynesian cross, which many students would be aware of. And it simply posits, and it's a device that was invented, in fact, by the American Keynesian, post-war Keynesian, Paul Samuelson. It wasn't in Keynes' book, The General Theory, but Paul Samuelson developed that device, the so-called 45-degree diagram. And that's often at the heart of any thinking, and it motivates implicitly policy responses to any downturn in big Y or national income. And why I say that's crude Keynesianism is because it leaves out money, it leaves out funds, it leaves out expectations, it leaves out those important factors that actually mitigate against the stimulus as such. They counteract. Once you bring in those key variables, indispensable, you can't assume them away, and you cannot also assume away public debt that arises as a consequence of increased government spending and budget deficits. And public debt doesn't figure in Keynes's original work, The General Theory, which is very curious, because when you increase public debt, it has all sorts of negative ramifications.
Yes.
So crude Keynesianism, in a nutshell, is that if governments spend, it stimulates output and hence employment, because at the heart of the idea is that if you're increasing spending, you're increasing employment. But there's a whole range of reasons, particularly when you look at the economy as an open economy, why that's not necessarily going to work.
Okay, Tony, could I just ask about John Maynard Keynes? So Keynesianism is a doctrine that comes from John Maynard Keynes, who was a famous British economist, born in 1883, I believe, died in the just after the war, and he worked for, well, he was at Cambridge University, he was an advisor to the the British Treasury. He advised various prime ministers, worked on the financing of World War One. He was involved in establishing the international financial system after the war. He was at the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944, if I remember correctly. Now, Keynes, he was writing at a time of the Great Depression, wasn't he? So he had recommendations regarding what governments should do in the Depression, and he was arguing that because there was a collapse in private investment, big I, and also big C, the consumption in that national income accounting equation, that we need to spend, governments need to invest, we need an increase in big G. And Keynes had some interesting examples, didn't he? He had the example about the Treasury burying bottles full of banknotes or paying people to dig up bottles, didn't he? There were some really interesting examples in there. His whole idea was the government just has to spend money to keep people, to get people employed, to the economy's in a rut, it's in a hole, and it needs a big push to get it out of it. Is that a reasonable summary?
That's a very good summary, Gene. That's exactly what he advocated. And a couple of points in response is that he assumed economies were closed. There's no exports or imports or exchange rates or capital flows or foreign debt, foreign investment in his original theory. And that came under criticism from a subsequent British economist, Hubert Henderson, who said that nothing in Henderson's opinion had led economics more astray than Keynes's hypothesis of reasoning that economies were closed, or words to that effect. And he said this is totally at odds with the tradition of British economics. Adam Smith, David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill had all taken international factors into account when they're looking at how economies behave. So that was one major omission in Keynes's theory. And secondly, it's not entirely correct that that Keynesianism actually worked during the Great Depression. It said that governments didn't spend enough, but the Secretary of the US Treasury at the end of the 1930s said that we've spent so much and it still doesn't work. And then the Second World War commenced soon after that, of course. But the jury's still out on, you know, how effective that Keynesianism of the 1930s actually was. It was a very prolonged depression and the spending had been increased. And some argue that because of the increased uncertainty that arose due to the big budget deficits and government interference in a major way in that period. It wasn't just through fiscal policy, but there were all sorts of interventions in the labour market and so on that created great uncertainty that prevented private investment reviving and hence prolonged the Great Depression. In addition to that, and probably the major factor, was that the US went highly protectionist. The tariffs that were imposed under the so-called Smoot-Hartley bill in the 1930s was trying to close the US economy off to foreign competition. Tariffs went up enormously and global trade collapsed, and that also contributed to the prolongation of the depression.
Yes, very good point there about the tariffs. Tony, I'd like to ask about the Australian response. I thought you made some really great observations about the different elements of the response. So there was the JobKeeper program, a payroll subsidy program, and then there were cash handouts. You made some, and there's also some bringing forward of infrastructure spending. You made some really insightful remarks regarding the efficacy, regarding the merits of the different elements of the Australian government response, and I think they're lessons that can apply to responses across the world. Would you be able to take us through what those insights and lessons that you made were, please, Tony?
Yeah, Well, I made a distinction between fiscal responses that were targeting the aggregate supply side of the economy, and in the paper endorsed those in principle. And in particular, we're talking about JobKeeper, which I think is a great innovation. We've not seen a scheme like that before. It's not original to Australia. Australia copied what was happening in the UK and New Zealand and one or two other European economies. And the innovation was to see firms as the source of employment, correct, and to alleviate the pressure on firms and their employees in particular by providing a direct subsidy to the firm. So it was a supply side initiative more than a demand side initiative. It was helping aggregate supply. It wasn't an element that was sought to increase C or I. It was increasing G, of course, but it was aimed at the firm's production. So that was an innovation, and I think there's a prototype there for future fiscal responses in heaven. Let's hope we don't have similar sort of crises, but it's a preferred means as opposed to the aggregate demand side response. And they were in the form of cash transfers or cash handouts, as we saw in response to the GFC, trying to, in the Keynesian way, stimulate spending. And the purpose of stimulating the spending is to enhance employment. So it's a roundabout way of trying to enhance employment. I think it has the features of a subsidy to retailers, in effect, because they're the ones that benefit most. And in any case, if there is spending, and evidence shows that such handouts tend to be largely saved, but if they are spent, they are spent on imports and they're funded by borrowing from overseas, which has to be paid in the future. So there were two responses there that were trying to sustain employment. One was a direct one through JobKeeper. Good marks for that one. And then there was another one on top of that, which was the cash handouts, which was a roundabout way of sustaining employment when there was another policy in place for that purpose.
Yep. So this JobKeeper, it was originally costed at $130 billion. It turns out it may only cost $70 billion. There was a forecasting error, but that's tangential to our discussion. You did note that while JobKeeper is more justifiable than other stimulus or emergency measures, there are still concerns with the design of JobKeeper. Could you take us through some of those, please, Tony?
Oh, look, the key one is the industries involved, the questions about casuals being paid more on JobKeeper than they were otherwise earning. So they're being paid more not to work than to work. I think that's the key flaw with the program, and hopefully that will be fixed when the Treasury completes its review very soon. And I guess there's also questions about, you know, eligibility and the rule that was there for downturn in sales. Some of those aspects of it could be possibly fine-tuned, but I think it is a useful prototype that can be improved.
Yep. If they did it again, I'm sure they would better target it, and they might target it to the industries that are most affected, such as hospitality, tourism, retail, possibly not professional services, which appear to be, well, not as badly affected as some other sectors. So the key lesson is that this needs to be better targeted. The problem was, from what I can tell, this was developed within a week, possibly under a week, toward the end of March, when they realised that they needed something like this, because all of the employer groups were coming to the the government ministers and telling them we need this or we're going to have to sack millions of people. So I think that's what drove it. It was done very quickly.
Yes, and also the alternative was to put enormous pressure on the employment benefit scheme, people queuing up for benefits. That would have been a major headache as well.
Absolutely. I think one of the great points you made in the paper was regarding the cash handouts. We want to get people out spending, but the public health advice is saying, actually, stay home. We don't want you to go out. So I thought that was a really interesting point. And actually, yes, that's right. So the goal of these emergency measures should be to sustain businesses, to keep people in employment during this challenging time. It's not necessarily, and the way to do that is not necessarily to give people money to go out and spend on new flat screen TVs, which are imported. So that's, I think that's a good point that you've made. What about infrastructure, Tony? What do you think about spending on infrastructure as a means to stimulate the economy and get people into employment?
Yes, infrastructure spending can be beneficial and it has lasting benefits. And what it does not do is deteriorate the government balance sheet, as does the spending on cash handouts and other forms of consumption-related government stimulus. What infrastructure does is it creates an asset there on the government's balance sheet that matches the borrowing. It still has to be funded by borrowing. We started with a budget deficit, so all of this extra spending has to be funded by borrowing. And so there's an asset there, so the balance sheet won't deteriorate to the extent otherwise. But again, it needs to be quality spending. It needs to pass certain tests. The crude Keynesian idea would be, again, just to spend on anything and digging holes in the ground, as you mentioned it earlier, is a form of crude Keynesianism, which could well be sort of portrayed as a form of infrastructure spending if it's working on the road somewhere. But the point about infrastructure spending is it does have to pass the test where the benefits, the present value of the benefits of the project exceed the costs. And one other point to make about infrastructure spending, and this is one feature of government spending that Keynes instanced in his work originally right back in the 1930s, but he talked about public works, which is effectively what we call infrastructure today. But the difference between then and now, when you talk about boosting infrastructure spending, is that the nature of the workforce has changed dramatically. I mean, people these days have certain skills. It's a highly variegated workforce, people doing different things. And the assumption in Keynes's theory was that you increase spending on public works, then you have workers easily transferred from jobs that they've lost, places of employment where they used to be in factories and other areas of unskilled work, and they can easily be transferred to, you know, working on the road, so to speak. But these days that seems far-fetched because, for instance, baristas who've lost their jobs are not necessarily going to want to be out there on the road as a construction worker. Financial sector employees are not wanting to be perhaps putting pink bats in ceilings. So the nature of the workforce is important. We can't just treat the labour force as this homogenous entity where people can transfer across to any sort of industry at whim. And there's also, I mean, there's information costs there. There's transactions costs which make the whole process a little bit trickier than it sounds in terms of increasing employment.
Yeah, it's not like it was in the 30s when you could get a whole bunch of unskilled or semi-skilled workers, unemployed workers, and have them carve out a walking track in the national park or something like that.
No, exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. So there are a few examples of projects like that in Australia where there were unemployed workers employed to do jobs just like that. I might put some links in the show notes. There are some in the show notes. There are some fascinating examples. Okay, Tony, let's get on to your criticisms of crude Keynesianism. So you talked about the open economy perspective before. You've also, in your paper, you also talk about the loanable funds view and Ricardian equivalence. So these are all alternative perspectives. And you write, these non-Keynesian perspectives backed by a body of empirical evidence tell us extra government spending aimed at bolstering the aggregate demand side has offsetting effects elsewhere in the economy that negate its purpose. So that's a very strong statement. I'm interested in the logic and evidence behind that statement, please, Tony. Would you be able to take us through that, please?
Sure, Gene. I set out the perspectives contrary to the crude Keynesian approach in my book, The Limits to Fiscal Policy, published just a few years ago, Palgrave Macmillan book, The Limits to Fiscal Policy, where I talk about the offsetting effects to increase government spending. The focus is mainly on increasing government spending as the form of fiscal injection. I hesitate to use the word stimulus because, as the book argues, that it's not really, in the end, stimulus at all. But the even before we talk about the open economy perspectives, we can hark back to criticisms that have been made when you treat the economy as a closed economy, as we said earlier, Keynes assumed. And criticisms from way back suggested that once you bring funds in, the flow of funds into the economy, then the pressure from government spending will increase interest rates because there's an increased demand for funds. Governments have to borrow the funds to finance the extra spending. So that would put up push up interest rates, put up put pressure on interest rates domestically, and that would crowd out domestic investment. So those funds would then no longer be available for investment. And a couple of recent papers have talked about the and have quantified the extent of this when the banking sector buys government bonds, when the banking sector is buying large quantities of newly issued government bonds that have been issued to fund the budget deficits, then that's becoming an asset on their balance sheets instead of loans to the private sector, to business for investment purposes. So that's one perspective, is the sort of classic loanable funds perspective, which is grounded in indisputable accounting, macro accounting, in fact. If you go to the identities in the national accounts, you will come out with that model, with the interest rate as the equilibrating variable between saving and investment.
Yeah, so the difference between the classical view and the Keynesian view is that it's not just the interest rate that leads to the equality of saving and investment, but the adjustment of income. I mean, that's probably something to cover in an additional episode because we could spend half an hour or an hour chatting about that. But, yes, so Paul Krugman, I'll link to a paper by Krugman on the ISLM model, because ISLM attempts to integrate that loanable funds view with the Keynesian view, and there's a huge debate about to what extent it does that adequately. So I might have to leave that for another discussion. But, so I'd be interested in
those. I was just about to get on.
Sorry, Tony?
I say I was just about to get on to ISLM as the next step.
Oh, good. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you see, ISLM was invented by Sir John Hicks, the Nobel Prize winner, who a contemporary of Keynes pointed out to him in a paper published, I think it was in Economica, that Keynes had omitted to address the monetary side of the economy. And so he introduced money demand and supply and presented the ISLM framework for the first time. And that framework, again, a closed economy framework, was used by Milton Friedman to say, well, in the monetary monetarist theory, the quantity theory of money, explaining how money and inflation are determined, how money determines the inflation rate, if it's excessively produced, increased supply of money leads to higher inflation, the classic quantity theory. In that theory, there's no role for the interest rate as a determinant of money demand. And so Friedman said, well, if you've got, if that is the case, you're going to have a vertical LM curve. And again, listeners might recall their ISLM analysis. And if you've got a vertical LM curve, even in a closed economy, if you increase big G, you're still going to crowd out investment, right? So it's consistent then with loanable funds. But they're closed economy models. I'd prefer to stress more the open economy counter arguments to crude Keynesianism, and there's several models there, so I could go through those.
Yes, please. Yes, if you could take us through that basic the mechanism, what happens, and how does it offset the impacts of the stimulus?
Okay, sure. So in the open economy, where you introduce capital flows, exports, imports, exchange rates, and emphasizing in particular the exchange rate, then you can have a counter model to crude Keynesianism. And the best known approach is the so-called Mundell-Fleming model, which features in intermediate macroeconomics textbooks. And it really just builds upon the ISLM model that Hicks invented by introducing capital flows and exchange rates and net exports. So listeners may well be familiar with that model, but simply says that if you increase government spending, you're going to increase the budget deficit. There's going to be more spending in the economy, but that for a given money supply is going to tend to push up domestic interest rates relative to foreign interest rates, and that will induce capital inflow. Foreigners will be flooding in to buy these bonds that are paying a slightly higher interest rate than in their own countries, and that capital inflow will appreciate the currency. So we're talking about a floating exchange rate here, and that appreciation will worsen competitiveness because in the short run, price levels are fixed, so a nominal appreciation will translate to a real appreciation, and that loss of competitiveness will crowd out net exports. And this is exactly what we saw post GFC, and I've written on this. It's part of the Treasury External paper, but the exchange rate appreciated massively as the fiscal stimulus was being rolled out, and just look at the national accounts and you see that the swing variable there was net exports that went down due to the loss of competitiveness. So that's one open economy perspective, and I think that model has been borne out empirically with reference to Australia's previous experience post-GFC.
Yes, I'll put a link to that paper of yours, which I think was in Agenda, and you also wrote a paper for the Minerals Council. One thing which was one thing that's really interesting, Tony, is that your original Minerals Council paper was criticised by the Treasury Secretary, Dr. Martin Parkinson, my old boss at the time, but then a couple of years later, you wrote a paper for the Treasury under the new Secretary, John Fraser, essentially almost refuting what Dr. Parkinson wrote in that rather extraordinary refutation of your Minerals Council paper.
Yes, yes. It's quite curious and evidence that economists disagree, even heads of Treasury disagree in their economic thinking. So, yes, Martin Parkinson issued a press release criticising my Minerals Council paper, which was mostly about Australia's competitiveness. It was not focused essentially on fiscal policy. That was a part of it, but that's what copped the criticism from Treasury. And then subsequent to that, when John Fraser, Parkinson's successor, became Treasury head, he commissioned me to write a paper for Treasury, and that is available from their website, a Treasury external paper, where I elaborated on the aspects in the Minerals Council paper about fiscal policy and raised some of these issues about counter models to crude Keynesianism.
Yeah. It's interesting because, I mean, we both worked for Treasury at different times, though. And I remember the traditional Treasury view is that, well, you have to be careful about fiscal policy because it could end up being destabilising. There's the open economy impacts that you've mentioned. There's also the problem that you don't know whether you're intervening at the right time, the problem that, you know, the stimulus might come on when the economy is recovering anyway, and then it's, you know, it's not really necessary. So there are these lags involved. What happened, I think, during the GFC or the global financial crisis was that the Treasury people thought, and, you know, the politicians, Kevin Rudd, the Prime Minister, Wayne Swan, the Treasurer, they thought, well, we've got this huge shock coming from overseas. We've got to do something. So we're just going to throw as much money at the problem as we can to save the economy. That seems to be the logic. And though all of those old concerns about discretionary fiscal policy, what we call discretionary fiscal policy, as distinct from automatic stabilizers such as unemployment benefits, which increase during recessions, or the fact that your tax revenues fall during recessions, that old view that discretionary fiscal policy isn't sensible, that was just thrown out the window. And we're seeing it again now. So what do you have any views on why the Treasury line on fiscal policy has changed, Tony?
Well, I think it's become crude Keynesian. And there's another example that you hadn't mentioned, and it was the response to the Asian financial crisis, which was also a major a cataclysmic event at the time in terms of what happened to asset prices. And we, by then, had been heavily dependent on the Asia Pacific for our trade. Not so with the GFC, because our trade with North America, the North Atlantic region, was minimal compared to Asia, and yet the responses were completely different. In the first instance, there was virtually no fiscal response. There was a strong monetary response, which allowed the exchange rate to stay at a highly depreciated level, which saw us through that crisis. We didn't experience a recession that time. And that was what was happening with the global financial crisis. The exchange rate collapsed, not as much as it did during the Asian financial crisis, but the government of the day then panicked, reflecting the panic in the US. And by that time, interestingly, the International Monetary Fund had changed course in its thinking. It had traditionally been influenced by Chicago economists and had always highlighted, in my time working there, highlighted problems with activist fiscal policy, including the lags problem that you've mentioned. But there had been this major reversal of thinking at those levels, and the Australian government here panicked as a consequence of the crisis, where it should not have, given that the banking system here didn't collapse in the same way as it did in the United States. I fully endorse the underwriting of the system, of the banking system at the time, but the fiscal stimulus was completely over the top in my view.
Yep. And you mentioned the famous dictum from Badgett that central banks in a time of crisis should lend freely against good collateral. So providing that liquidity to the system, that's the major way that central banks can assist in a crisis. And, you know, you're comfortable with that. You're comfortable with monetary policy measures. It's the fiscal policy measures that you're less comfortable with because of the fact that there are those offsetting impacts and that fiscal legacy. Tony, would you have time for one more question? I know we've run a bit over time, but one more question on the fiscal legacy?
Sure.
Okay. What do you see as the problem with this? There's this buildup of debt, isn't there? And there's the problem we have to pay for it or we have to service that debt, and a lot of that money is going to go overseas. You've also mentioned the impact on economic growth. What evidence is there regarding the impact on economic performance and growth of a buildup of public debt, which is in Australia is easily going to exceed $1 trillion within a few years?
Yes, well, there's certainly going to be the impact on national income because there'll be a pure drain from national income of the public debt interest paid abroad. We're talking about tens of billions there that will be just be subtracted from national income to service the debt that we will have, and that drain will likely exceed, if it's a $1 trillion debt, it's likely to be about eight times the foreign aid budget and a multiple of what's spent on the pharmaceutical benefits scheme and a host of other government programs. So there's going to be a direct impact there. But there have been a number of elaborate econometric studies done, and you'll find them in the literature. I won't instance all the authors, but the IMF has done work on this. I've actually had a paper published with a PhD student of mine looking at Asian economies. And there seems to be a consensus empirically that a 10% increase in public debt, other things the same, will contract GDP growth, that's conventionally defined GDP, by 0.2%. So that might not sound much, but you compound that through, it can be quite significant after a few years.
What would be the mechanism there, Tony? Would it be the fact that to service this debt, you might have to have taxes higher than otherwise, and these taxes lead to an efficiency loss. There's an efficiency loss with taxation because you're discouraging people from working or investing. Could that be one of the mechanisms?
Yeah, absolutely. The interest rate is going to play a role as well. But there's going to be the dead weight losses of the future taxes are going to harm future income. There's no question about that. But also there's other studies have shown that the interest rate will increase by certain basis points. A 1% increase in the public debt to GDP ratio tends to, in these studies, show that the interest rate tends to go up by about 5 basis points or up to 5 basis points. But the mechanism through tax is important, but also through expectations. If you've got this big debt overhang, public debt overhang, that's going to affect expectations, and we can invoke Ricardo there in terms of what he said for households having to tending to save more, but also firms. And it's not something that Ricardo instanced, but I think it's important that investment is likely to be weak due to the uncertainty that business has about future tax liabilities in the face of an enormous public debt. And then lastly, there's the impact on future generations that Thomas Jefferson, the founding father of the United States, instanced, and that the future generations are going to have to pay for the repayment of the massive debt that's arisen due to the fiscal response.
Yep. Okay, Tony, that's been great. We didn't even get to modern monetary theory or some of the other topics in your paper, but I'll link to it for for listeners to read. I highly recommend it, A Fiscal Vaccine for COVID-19. Tony Makin, Professor of Economics at Griffith University. As Tony mentioned, he formerly worked for the International Monetary Fund. You've also worked for Australian government agencies. You've worked for University of Queensland, and you've taught at Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore. Tony, I really enjoyed that. Are there any final points in wrapping up?
Look, there's a lot more we could talk about, Gene, perhaps at another time. Modern monetary theory, I think, lends itself to a session. But anyway.
Absolutely. Okay. Tony, thank
you. Great talking to you. Thank you.
Oh, thanks so much, Tony. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
We've reached the end of another Economics Explained episode, so thanks for listening all the way through. If you're enjoying Economics Explained, please tell your family and friends and rate the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or on whatever platform you are listening on. Finally, if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please get in touch. My email address is gene.tunney@gmail.com. Until next week, goodbye.